julas tilbud hos Spar. Julefeiringen nærmer seg med stormskritt, og nå får du hele 40% rabatt på et stort utvalg Evergood kaffe. I tillegg får du også fersk krydder av tynnribber fra Folkets, før 149, nå kun 99 kroner per kilo. Alt I tilbud på noe godt. Hilsen oss I Spar.
Hei dere, velkommen til oss. Vi Biohacking Girls, din podcast for optimal helse.
Vi to jenter bak rattet. Dette Monica.
Og dette Alette. Vi biohacking-kollegaer og legger sammen våre erfaringer og kunnskap for å inspirere deg til å ta fatt på biohacking for å optimalisere helsen din.
Vi følger med og setter forstørrelsesglass på trender og siste forskning og snakker med verdens toppeksperter innen trening, life coaching, helse og biohacking.
Du klar for å starte med konkrete hacks, lytte til din egen kropp og ta fatt på din helsemessige reise sammen med oss?
Vi ønsker naturlig tilnærming til helsen vår, og vi snakker til både menn og kvinner.
Du kan gjerne gi tilbakemeldinger til oss under podcasten her, og slå gjerne til med en god stjerne.
Du finner oss også på Instagram og Facebook. Du klar? Velkommen! I dag har vi med oss Dr. Steven Hussey fra USA. Steven kiropraktor og praktiserende funksjonell medisiner. Da han var 2 år gammel ble han diagnostisert med astma og legen ga han inhalator og forstøver, men tilstanden hans ble stadig verre og han utviklet etter hvert både IBS og allergier, og 9 år gammel ble han diagnostisert med autoimmun type 1 diabetes. Og på denne tiden så var den eneste fornuftige veien vestlig medisin. Så han fikk enda mer medisiner, allergipiller, steroider, prednison og sirkelen var I gang. Hans egen sykdomshistorie motiverte han til å studere medisin. Han ønsket ikke å utvikle hjerteproblemer, nyreproblemer, øyeproblemer og så videre.
Nei, tvert imot. Steven Hussey, han tok faktisk doktorgrad I både kiropraktikk og en mastergrad I human ernæring og funksjonell medisin ved University of Western States I Portland, Oregon. Han helsecoach, han foredragsholder og han forfatter av 2 bøker. I dagens podcast skal vi fokusere på hjerte og alt dette med kolesterol. Boken Understanding the Heart, den mener vi bør være pensum for enhver biohacker. Den gir innsikt I den evolusjonære opprinnelsen til hjertesykdom. Mange hjertespesialister råder sine pasienter å holde seg unna fett. Vi veldig glad for at Steven Hussey oppklarer denne problematikken for oss. Om hvorfor animalsk fett bra, om alle kolesterolhypotesene og hvordan stress påvirker hjertehelsen vår.
Dette del 1 av 2 spennende episoder om hjertet, og I denne episoden så graver vi dypt for å forstå hvordan hjertet jobber og hva som skjer når man blir syke. Samt så snakker vi om kolesterol og mange feilslåtte, litt forvirrende ideer. Del gjerne denne episoden med noen du kjenner som kan ha glede av å lære mer om hjertehelse. Velkommen til Biohacking Girls podcast.
Thanks for joining our podcast, Dr. Steven Hussey. How has your morning been?
It's been great. Just woke up and did my usual health routine and then saw patients this morning and now I get to talk to you guys.
But what's your usual health routine in the morning?
I usually get up and do like 15, 20 minutes of like this kind of yoga stretching routine that I do. And then I will sit in the infrared sauna and get a good sweat. And then I'll usually meditate while I'm in the sauna. And then I get out of the sauna and do a cold shower. And then I just get ready to go to work. And I head to the office and see patients until about mid-morning.
Sounds like a great morning. And we love the book. We have been reading it and we really want to recommend it to everyone. And your health journey inspired you to do this book. Can you just, what happened?
Yeah, so I mean, from a very young age, I had a lot of inflammatory conditions. When I was a kid, I had irritable bowel syndrome. I had terrible allergies and asthma. And I used to break out in inflamed hives all over my body. My skin was just turned blotchy and red. And the doctors never really told me why or couldn't tell me why. My parents were just kind of relying on, you know, the doctors to help us manage these conditions. And ultimately, all that inflammation ended up with autoimmune type 1 diabetes, where my body, I mean, the theory is that my body attacked itself and the cells that make insulin insulin no longer make insulin because they were attacked. Although I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to that theory. But yeah, and so that being type 1 diabetic, you know, as hard as I've worked on my health all the years, I've cured all those things that I had, except for the type 1 diabetes, just kind of collateral damage that was created with all that inflammation. So that heavily predisposes me to heart disease. And so I've spent a long time looking into heart disease, trying to figure out, you know, what creates it. And I found a lot of things that aren't necessarily what I was told in my training in medical school and in my master's degree and everything. There's a lot of things that fly in the face of the conventional wisdom of what causes heart disease. So I've always been trying to prevent it, and sometimes unsuccessfully, because if people read my book, they will know that I did have a heart attack at the age of 34, which, you know, further pushed me into this realm of heart disease and trying to figure this thing out. And so all of what I found and all the misconceptions about heart disease that I found are in my book. And I started sharing that a while back and people seemed to like it. And so here I am, you know, talking about this, trying to get to the bottom of it, trying to find the truth, you know.
So we think everybody should read your book because it gives us such a deep understanding of everything around the heart. But why don't you share more about your own heart attack when you were 34? That's very young.
If you don't mind.
Of course, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I was doing many of the things that I had discovered over the years. You know, I'd always been really, really controlled about diet and, you know, not necessarily about other things that I had figured out. I wasn't the best at doing those things, but I was always really strict on diet. And so I say that first because I want people to understand that, you know, this conversation about heart disease is largely consumed by diet. Everybody talks about cholesterol, they talk about saturated fat and animal foods and everything like that and what you should eat to prevent heart disease. But in my opinion, based on everything I found, that is one very small part of what causes heart disease and what causes heart attacks. And so, you know, I had always been very strict on that and I still had a heart attack. And so even though my numbers and everything that are supposed to predict whether they have a heart attack all look good, I still had one. And so, yeah, I mean, at that time, I had the heart attack on January 5th, 2021. And so that was, you know, right after the first year of COVID and all the changes that we saw in the world at that time. And there were some personal things that I was going through that were quite stressful. And a day and a half before the heart attack, I had some very stressful news about a very close family member. And so, yeah, I was trying to think of how I could alleviate that situation. And there was nothing I could do. And that was the thing, is that nobody in me or my family could change that situation for this individual. And so it was the inability to do something that was quite stressful. And so, yeah, I woke up Tuesday morning after hearing the news Sunday night, and I did my usual, you know, workout and took a shower. And then I was standing there making lunch and I had a heart attack. And it was a massive heart attack. It was 100% clot formed in the left anterior descending artery. And so there was no atherosclerosis anywhere in the coronary arteries, just a giant clot formed in that artery. And there are reasons why I think that happened. And I go into more detail about those reasons in a talk that I gave at Roanoke College here locally. And I put that on my YouTube channel. If people want to go check that out, it's Resource Your Health. I go into more detail about exactly what I think happened to me in the heart attack. But long story short, I was laying there in the cardiac ICU thinking, I'm a hypocrite. Like, all these things I learned are, you know, I'm not doing them, or I was letting stress get to me, or all this stuff. And I had gotten away from meditating and I'd gotten away from doing the sauna and lots of different things. And so I was like, I can't release this book. There's no way. I mean, I can't. And then over the next 3 days, the experience I had in the hospital, you know, showed me that I really needed to release the book because, you know, they were completely confused about what causes heart disease, what causes heart attacks, and the advice they were giving me to prevent the next one, or it was just totally wrong. I mean, they were telling me to eat a processed food diet. It's terrible. Like, the diet they told me to eat was mainly processed foods, vegetable oils, processed grains, sugars, things like that. Just terrible foods. They were telling me to eat no salt to prevent heart failure and things like that. There was no talk of, you know, beneficial, I guess, lifestyle practices outside of like diet and exercise. They almost scared me about exercise. And they told me that I could do cardiac rehab and that was pretty much it. And so, which is a very, very minimal light exercise, which for me, I mean, maybe for some people I understand, but for someone like me, it didn't make sense. But it was clear that it was just a very cookie cutter approach. They put me on, or they tried to put me on 11 different medications while I was in the hospital. And so and when I disagreed with them, the worst part about the whole situation was that, not that I disagreed, but when I tried to open up the conversation and ask them why they wanted this, or what about this information, or this or that, they just shut down the conversation. Either they didn't know anything about it, or didn't have time to talk about it, or whatever it was. But it was just, the conversation was shut down. And so, you know, the main reason I decided to still release my book is because, you know, I'm not claiming in my book that everything I say is true or that it's accurate, but we need to open up the conversation. We need to not have it be shut down in the face of questioning so that we can find the answer, because clearly heart disease is the number one killer in the world, and it continues to be, and rates continue to go up. So we must not have it right. And so even if the ideas in my book are not completely accurate and they're just theories, but they're opening up the conversation so that we can find the answer.
But so many medications, it was really interesting to read your story because you dig deeper into it. But you did take one or two medications during this time. And I mean, you really need some force and belief in yourself to stand against all these advices you get from.
Absolutely. It's so impressive that you, went your own way.
I had just researched this whole book, you know, so I was pretty confident. You know, I could say things like, I know there's no evidence behind that, or there is evidence behind this. And I had that in my mind, whereas most people wouldn't know that. But, you know, that's what gave me that confidence. And I have, you know, medical training and that kind of thing. But yeah, I did take one medication for a while. That was the blood thinner, because I had a stent in my body and I didn't know how my body was going to react to that foreign object. So I took that for about 6 months, and I started taking one blood pressure medication and then talked to myself and let my senses get to me and realized that that was completely unnecessary. I took that for about 2 weeks. So I kind of let things get to me at some point, but I was very adamant about not taking statin drugs, cholesterol lowering drugs, because that was not the cause of anything. It never has. So yeah, I had to have that knowledge. And so that's another reason why I released the book, is that I think people should also have this knowledge so that if they're faced with the same decisions I was, they could make educated decisions about it and not just have to blindly trust their doctors. Even though the doctors may be well-intentioned, they may not have all the information. So I wanted to put the information out there.
So how has your healing process been after this? You were talking about food and workouts and lifestyle changes.
Yeah, so that was the thing, you know, that they were telling me all these different things, and I was in the hospital for 3 days, which I found out later that it's normal for someone to be in the hospital for a week after, having a heart attack. Yeah, so, but you know, they didn't know what to do with me anymore because I wasn't going to take their medications. I kept questioning or asking questions about their recommendations. And so I couldn't wait to get home and start my own routine. And so at this point, you know, I was fortunate, I guess, because I just researched this whole book. And I took everything that I learned in that book or from writing that book and implemented it into myself, you know? And so, yeah, at my 3 month echocardiogram, my heart had pretty much 100% healed. My ejection fraction, which is how much blood is ejected out of your heart every beat, had decreased to below normal. And it was in the normal range at my 3 month echocardiogram, and there was no evidence of heart failure. The part of my heart muscle tissue that had been damaged was almost completely back to normal again. So it's been almost 2 years now. So I imagine that that's completely back to normal now, because that was only at 3 months. And, you know, my cardiologist was kind of stunned. He was just like, "You didn't take any medications?" And I was like, "No." I told him what I did. He didn't really seem interested. But I stayed on the type of whole food diet that I'm usually on, which is high in animal products and very metabolically healthy, you know, decreased toxins. But I really got into, I use my sauna like every day, or at least, you know, 5 to 6 times a week during this time. And then I also decreased toxins quite a bit, but also really got into like the mindfulness aspect of things, you know, the meditation and just that aspect. Because that was, I think, what drove my heart attack, is that improper stress response that I had. So yeah, I mean, I did that and I got great results. And I understand, you know, that I was 34, 35 at that time. And so I'm younger and I've taken care of myself prior to that. So my recovery was probably at better odds from the start. But, you know, in doing those things and not following their recommendations, not eating the diet they recommended, not avoiding exercise and doing my own thing. And I took certain supplements too that were helped with heart healing that weren't recommended to me, which the research is pretty robust about some of these nutrients. So I don't understand why it's not recommended. So yeah, and my heart has done well. I'd say 100% recovered and living my best life. So,
but are you like conscious or anxious about it?
You know, I'd be lying if I said no. You know, once that happens, I mean, it's scary. During the entire thing, I never felt like, oh, this is it, I'm going to die. I was just like, I got to get to the hospital. They have to do a cath and I'll figure it out from there. It was never like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die, which I don't know why. I mean, I could have been very close to that. But yeah, there's always an aspect of fear of that happening again, you know, and I think there always will be, but it's become much less so over time as I do more and more things and get back to more and more normal of a life, which I have pretty much 100% now. And, you know, I think it was a wake-up call for me. It was a wake-up call in that, you know, stress kills, and how you let stress affect you kills. It does. And I was very good at controlling diet, and I had not paid attention to that. And so I feel like it's almost like a wake-up call that reinforced a lot of what I said in the book and also gave me a little bit of a calling, like to identify this and to draw the attention away from cholesterol and saturated fat and diet, the diet aspect of heart disease, and start drawing attention to the bigger aspects that maybe aren't as profitable for a pharmaceutical company to pay attention to, but very, very important, and they need to be talked about.
Yeah, but let's go back a couple of years, because through your extensive research, we want to know about the history of heart disease. What happened in the 50s with Ansel Keys and everything?
Yeah. So how did we get to this time now where everybody thinks that cholesterol causes heart disease and exactly. that saturated fat and red meat are demonized? Like, how did we get there? Well, first of all, it's humans and pre-humans, the species that came before modern humans have been eating red meat and saturated fat as a large part of their diet for a very, very long time. And it's only, and heart disease itself is a very modern disease. If we look at it in the epidemic that we have it today, yes, there's evidence that some civilizations had aspects of heart disease, like the Egyptians and things like that. But as far as the epidemic that we know it and the number one cause of disease, is a very new disease. So how could a food we've been eating forever be the cause of a modern disease, a disease that we're only seeing in modern times, at least in these levels? Doesn't make sense. So there's that. And then in the 1940s and 1950s, heart disease started to become more and more prevalent. The rates were rising. And President Eisenhower had a heart attack very famously while he was in the Oval Office, And so it was all over the news, and it was this scary thing that was rising, kind of like when people talked about COVID the last 3 years. It was this scary thing that was rising. And, you know, whatever you think about COVID, you know, like, that's what was happening. This fear was being created, you know. And so the same thing was happening with heart disease. And so people were looking for answers. And this one guy named Ansel Keys gave everybody an answer. And he did some research that we call epidemiology, which is a type of research that can only show that two things are associated with each other, but it can't show that one's causing the other. It's the lowest form of research. And he did this form of research, and he showed that in some countries, the more saturated fat and cholesterol they ate, the more heart disease they had. However, what you don't know, what you don't hear, is that at the time there was data available. That type of data was available from 22 countries. And he picked the 6 countries. And then later he did another study where he picked 7 countries that gave him that association, that gave him the right answer that he wanted. And he ignored the other countries' data. And so he kind of cherry picked the data. And so later, I think it was maybe 5 years later, 2 other scientists repeated that study. And they'd used all the data that was available at the time. And they found no correlation whatsoever. But by the time they had tested this theory that eating more saturated fat and higher cholesterol levels would cause heart disease, the theory had already taken off. And there's a lot of money behind it from industries that would benefit from decreasing saturated fat intake and increasing sugar and grain intake. So those industries, you know, kind of took that theory and ran with it. And so by the time the studies came out that showed that the more unsaturated fat you ate, the more heart disease you would get, because there's lots of those studies that directly show that. Before those studies came out, the theory had taken off. And so that's why we are here today. Lots of money backing this idea for a very long time. And it's only recently that lots of studies are starting to come out. You know, people are actually eventually starting to do the studies. It's not like that all this time the studies weren't showing this. It's that nobody was looking at them, or they were ignoring the ones. And now there's big studies coming out of, you know, the American Journal of Cardiology saying that, oh, the information on saturated fat was probably pretty overblown, and that's not really the case. This idea that cholesterol and saturated fat cause heart disease is completely unfounded. There's no real evidence behind it. And there's actually evidence to the contrary. But it all makes sense too, because cholesterol is a vital molecule in the body. And it's needed for lots of different things. And so it makes sense that we're coming back around to that.
Yeah, this cholesterol scare has really wrecked us, I would say. But Stephen, what causes heart disease then? What have you found?
Yeah, you know, a logical question. If it's not cholesterol and saturated fat, then what is it? And so when you talk about what causes heart disease, there's different types of heart disease, right? There's atherosclerosis, which is the hardening of the arteries or plaque buildup in the arteries. There's a heart attack or myocardial infarction, and then there's heart failure. There could also be like different arrhythmias, or there could be cardiac arrest, which is a bit different from myocardial infarction, even though it's kind of this, you know, this situation that, it, you know, really hurts the heart itself. But when we're talking about saturated fat cholesterol, the main idea is that saturated fat or cholesterol builds up in your bloodstream, and then it clogs your arteries, or it gets stuck on the side of the artery and clogs it. And that's not what happens. So we have to ask ourselves, why do we get atherosclerosis? Why do we get plaque buildup on the side of the arteries? And it's the same kind of thing. If we look at what an atherosclerosis is, if we like took some of it out of an artery and analyzed it, like out of a cadaver, we'd see that the largest percentage of it, like 87 to 90% of it, is fibrous tissue, which means clotting tissue. So the clotting tissue is what happens. Like if you cut your hand, and a scab forms on it to stop the bleeding, that's clotting. The body's clotting that so you don't keep bleeding because you don't want to lose all your blood. So the same kind of thing, more or less, happens in the lining of the artery. If we get damage to the lining of the artery, then the body, like it's supposed to be able to repair that damage, the body. And so to do that, we need insulin signaling. We need proper insulin signaling to trigger that damage to be repaired. However, if the damage becomes too much or we become insulin resistant, i.e. type 2 diabetic, then we can't repair that damage and the body has to do something else. And what it does is it forms clots. It forms clotting material so that the lining of the artery doesn't start bleeding and we start, you know, bleeding out, right? So that's what's happening. And so if we're doing things to damage the lining of the arteries, then and we're not able to repair it as well, then we get atherosclerosis. So natural question there is what damages the lining of the arteries, right?
Right.
And so what damage, there's many things that can do this. There could be, and cholesterol can do that, but it's not the cholesterol that does it. It's the things that damage cholesterol that then causes damaged cholesterol to damage the lining of the artery. So we blame the wrong thing, right? So there's lots of things. There is toxin exposure, so different heavy metals or everything from artificial fragrances to things you put, cleaning products, things like that, all these different things that are just these synthetic chemicals that humans have made over the years that are very incompatible with our physiology. So toxin exposure, toxins have been heavily linked, you know, BPA in plastics, things like that. Those things are heavily linked to development of atherosclerosis. There's psychological stress, which is, if you look at studies that show that being stressed or acute stress can damage the lining of the artery, it's just robust. There's so much evidence that that's the case. There's something called endotoxemia, which is when bacteria get into the bloodstream. And that can happen if we have poor dental health or poor gut health. That bacteria can get into the bloodstream. And when the body attacks that bacteria, it releases toxins that also cause atherosclerosis. So it can be a diet that creates I would call poor metabolic health, which means you're not metabolizing your food in a way that's healthy. And so that type of diet, which is full of vegetable oils and processed grains and processed sugars and things like that, can be very damaging to the lining of the artery and cause a lot of inflammation. And so all this stuff can kind of create this storm that damages the artery. And then, like I said, if we can't repair it because of various things, like if it's too much damage or if it's we're not responding to insulin well because we're in that type 2 diabetic state, then the body has to do something else, and that is form clots. And then clots can form on clots on clots on clots, and it builds up this atherosclerotic plaque in the arteries.
Well, is there any times of the year or week that we suffer from more heart attacks than others?
Definitely, yeah. And so a lot of this has to do with like these three imbalances that I talk about in the book. And I've kind of alluded to two of them already, which were, you know, good metabolic health, but also decreased toxin exposure. And then the third one is imbalance in the autonomic nervous system, which is basically an improper stress response. We don't respond to stress well, which is what I had gotten it kind of into. I got into this space where I'm not having a proper stress response. But what we see is that when it gets colder outside during the winter, we're not spending as much time outside. A lot of these imbalances are more pronounced, I'd say. So if we're already metabolically unhealthy, and then we go toward the holidays where people are eating, you know, more processed food and things like that, we're not as willing to go out and get fresh food and things like that. We kind of stay in and we eat maybe the processed food that stays better, you know. That kind of thing happens toward the winter. We also spend less time outside. So, you know, we're not in contact with the earth as much. We're not getting as much sunlight, those types of things. And those can all mess with our stress response that can cause inflammation. We also spending more time inside also exposes us to more man-made toxins, because we're not out in the ventilated air as much, you know. And so even just, daylight savings time is another thing that really sets off our circadian rhythm, which is incredibly important to our stress response. And so all these things that happen seasonally, specifically going in toward colder months, is why we see more heart attacks in the colder months, in my opinion. And but it's all because of we're driving these three imbalances that happen. But there's evidence that heart attacks are more common on Mondays when people are going back to work and it's stressful. There's evidence that heart attacks are more common on days where there's big sporting events, where people are betting on the events and they're very stressed about it, you know, or they're just really passionate about their team or something and it stresses them out. There's evidence that heart attacks are more common around different holidays because holidays can be very stressful for people as far as money and, you know, pressure from family and these types of things and pressure from work to get things done. Like, it's a stressful time, unfortunately, for lots of people. So there's a reason for that, and it's because it drives these imbalances.
Wow. Vi bryter inn for å fortelle hvordan det går med vårt supre samarbeid med Oslo Skin Lab og kollagenpulveret The Solution. Vi har brukt kollagenet nå I 12 uker uten pause, og kan endelig dele resultater på den andre hudskanningen vi har gjort.
Vi må si at vi tok første scan, så sa Maybritt på Oslo Hudpleieklinikk at vi begge hadde et veldig godt utgangspunkt, og at vi kanskje ikke kunne vente revolusjonerende resultater sånn med en gang.
The Solution et kollagenpulver som kommer I porsjonspakker, hvor du tar en om dagen. Det veldig enkelt, og vår favoritt å bare blande denne I kaffen. Helt smakløst, og en pose en dags porsjon.
The Solution hydrolysert kollagen, altså kollagen som brutt ned til en helt bestemt peptidlengde. Hydrolysering ser ut til å være det som må til for å få effekt på hudens glatthet og spenst. Kollagenpeptidene I The Solution spesialdesignet til å fungere på hud, og minimerer linjer og rynker, øker spenst og reduserer cellulitter.
Som biohackere valgte vi nettopp The Solution kollagenpulver fordi det god forskning på at dette faktisk hjelper på fine linjer og elastitet I huden. Det lærerikt å jobbe med Oslo Skin Lab, og de har vært veldig flinke til å svare på alle våre nerdete spørsmål om dette pulveret.
Så til resultatene på hudskanningen. Vi får vel si at vi rimelig fornøyde, Monica?
Ja, mine rynker ble målt med 6% færre etter 12 uker, og på øynene så var linjene redusert, og bedringen kunne man se her helt på 10%, både på fasthet og tetthet.
Og jeg hadde også stor økning I elastitet og spenst I huden med nesten 20%, og når det kom til rynker så hadde jeg det samme som Monica, kanskje litt mindre, kanskje bare 5% der. Vi veldig fornøyde. Maybritt fortalte også at det kan ta tid å få resultater, og vi ble enige om at en ny scan etter sommeren veldig lurt, sånn at vi venter 12 nye uker før neste scan.
Dette kollagenpulver kan vi virkelig stå inne for, og om du vil teste, så har vi en rabattkode som heter BIOHACKING60. Da får du 60% på din første måned og 30% etter det. Gå inn på osloskinlab.no.
So, could we talk a little bit about glucose and ketones, how they play a role? Can you explain why the ketones is a better fuel source for the heart?
Yeah, definitely. So, there's a lot of evidence that the heart prefers fatty acids and ketones as a fuel source. And most of the organs do, but the heart seems to have a special affinity for, like, even in the presence of glucose, the heart will choose to burn ketones. So it's, I think, very important to make sure that there's fatty acids and ketones around, you know, for the heart to be able to do that. And that comes down to eating a diet that creates metabolic health that, you know, encourages your body to make ketones, at least on occasion, you know, at least once a day or something like that. And so if we think about fatty acids and ketones are just much cleaner fuel sources, meaning that when you burn them for fuel, you're making less exhaust. It's just kind of like in a car, you know, like they burn a fuel and you make an exhaust. And so we kind of have an exhaust too, even though really none of those byproducts that we would consider exhaust are actually waste products. Your body uses them for things. But if we're talking about a clean fuel source, fatty acids and ketones are the cleanest. And so if we look at studies where muscle is burning glucose, it creates much more what we call oxidative stress, which is when we have an abundance of, say, exhaust, we'll say, and that causes damage to the body, right? And so we want to stay away from primarily burning glucose, sugar. We want to primarily burn fatty acids and ketones to prevent that, you know, that exhaust from forming too much. And so in the heart, it's specifically important Because if our heart gets too used to burning glucose, or it's forced to burn more glucose than it wants to, that can actually predispose us to what I call metabolic heart attacks, which are heart attacks that happen when there's no blockage anywhere. Like there's no artery that's blocked, and or there's no artery that's fully blocked. So the idea is that heart attacks happen when an artery is blocked and no blood can get to the tissue, and that causes tissue death, which is what happened to me. So it does happen, but there are lots of heart attacks where that's not the case. And I think they're a result of poor metabolism of the heart combined with stress. And so if the heart's used to or being forced to burn more glucose than it would like to, and it comes to a stress response, without having those fatty acids and ketones around, it can create a very dangerous situation where we're burning more glucose than the heart wants to. And that's kind of like when you go for a run and your muscle starts burning glucose and you start to feel muscle burn in your leg. You can just stop running if that hurts too much, but your heart just can't stop contracting. So if that happens in the heart, that can become a big issue, and it can actually create a situation where blood is prevented from getting to the heart tissue, but in a different way than a blockage due to poor metabolism, and that can cause tissue death in the heart as well. And we see that over and over again. I've had so many people come to me and say, yeah, I had a heart attack and there was no blockage. And that's usually what's happening, is this poor metabolism. So fatty acids and ketones are always the better fuel source. So we want to eat in a way that ensures that our heart will always have access to those.
And still, this was not a recommendation you got from you from the hospital when you were sick.
Definitely not. They were telling me to eat a diet that creates poor metabolic health.
Yeah.
Diet products. Sad.
Yeah. Carbs.
Without. Yeah. But if anyone now, they're worried about heart disease and want to check if they are in risk, what's some of the best tests you can do with your doctor? Because I mean, the ultrasound, that it won't then, yeah, maybe it's clear, but you can still be at risk. What do you recommend?
Yeah, so I like to start off this question with a more philosophical answer first, and then I'll give details about what you should test for or what you can test for. You know, testing is, it's a human invented thing, right? And so you take blood work, for example. Like blood work is, it's a, taking a sample of the body at one snapshot in time, and it's one tissue of the body, it's just the blood. And so assuming that we can assess risk or assess if we're healthy or not from that type of, you know, narrow view of things, it's pretty short-sighted in my opinion. And so I always look at testing, and I advise people to do testing if they want to, but I don't think that people should base their whole, whether or not they're healthy or whether or not they're at risk, based on this alone, whether it's an echocardiogram or blood work or whatever it is, because it's just humans who are flawed looking at humans to see if they're flawed, right? And so we just have to understand that and take testing with a grain of salt. And I'd like to kind of step back and you recognize, be humble before the human body, because it's a very complex biological ecosystem that has been evolving for, you know, very, very long time. And so we will probably never fully understand the ins and outs of the body. However, there are some things we can look at that can kind of give us, you know, an assessment of so-called risk. And so I take it back to the three imbalances I talk about in my book: poor metabolic health, inflammation and oxidative stress, and imbalance in the autonomic nervous system stress response. Okay. So for metabolic health, the two best things you can look for on blood work are the trig to HDL ratio, the triglyceride to HDL ratio. And you know, everybody's looking at cholesterol and total cholesterol and LDL on their lipid panel, but really they should be looking at the triglyceride to HDL ratio. Now, I don't know the numbers for Europe as far as the conversion, but as far as in the US, like you should be that if you divide triglycerides by HDL, it should be a ratio of 1.5 or lower.
Yeah, it's the same here.
Okay, yeah. Good. And so, if you do that, then that's a good assessment of metabolic health. And then the other one is the fasting insulin level, which most doctors won't take. They don't understand why you would take it. But that's a good assessment for, are you insulin resistant? Because insulin resistance is a much better predictor of atherosclerosis or heart disease than cholesterol ever will be. So those are the two good tests there. And then the second one is measuring inflammation and oxidative stress, which are, they're different, but they're the kind of same thing because they cause the same issues in the body. And one good marker for just general inflammation in the body is HSCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein. That's just going to tell you if there's some inflammation. And you could test a lot of different things, like is there inflammation of the lining of the artery and all this kind of stuff. But it kind of gets into the weeds. Like it really gets too like technical. You don't need all that because whether or not those numbers are elevated, the treatment for them is either going to be good for you and prevent it from being elevated, or it's going to fix them, you know? So it doesn't really matter. Just do those things. You don't need to test for it and spend money if you don't have it, you know? And so then you could measure different DNA damage to things. You can measure damage to fatty acids, and this will all give you an idea about oxidative stress. But I like just taking what's called a liver enzyme called GGT. That's a good marker of is the liver dealing with more oxidative stress than it should be. And that's probably good enough there. And then the last imbalance, which is the imbalance in the stress response, the best measure there is heart rate variability. And heart rate variability is basically it's measuring your ability to adapt to stress. And so it's kind of, I always say that there's no mistake that, you know, the organ or the way that we measure our stress response and kind of how stressed we are and how emotionally sound we are is measured through this organ that also we associate with emotion, like our heart. So heart rate variability, there's no mistake there. That was not a coincidence. But heart rate variability is basically the time between heartbeats, and we want it to be variable. And so the variability assesses our ability to handle a stress and come back to normal, because health is the ability to adapt to a stress and come back to normal. That's what homeostasis is. So if we have totally normal blood sugar control, we should be able to eat a high carbohydrate thing. The blood sugar would go up and then it would come right back down within 2 hours. That's normal. That's a healthy blood sugar response. If we want a healthy stress response, then our body should experience a stress, and then it would have the appropriate response to get us away from that stress or fight off that stress or whatever. And then it would go back to normal within, you know, 15 minutes or so. And if that doesn't happen, that suggests a health issue, right? Our body is not able to adapt. And if we get stuck in this state where we can't adapt, that's a problem, because then we can't adapt to the world. And those things that we should be able to adapt to actually cause us illness, right? And so that's what heart rate variability is measuring. The fasting insulin and metabolic health assessment, it's all measuring that stuff. How adapted are you to, or how are you able to adapt to stresses?
But I think we should go back a little bit to the cholesterol, because that's pretty much on everybody's lips these days. As we eat keto or we eat more proteins and fat, the levels go up, as you know. And so many people are afraid these days because the doctors, they would recommend the statins and pretty much based on the LDL levels, but they don't go behind to do like the lipo prints. They just do it based on the general basis of the LDLs. Can you just update us? How is it in the States and what are your reflections around this trend with statins for every elevated number?
Yeah, there's even talk at one point, I don't know if there still is, but there was even talk about people trying to put statins in the drinking water so that everybody would have them, which is really, really crazy. With cholesterol, again, looking at it and to think that this one molecule is the driver of an entire chronic disease just doesn't make sense when we look at how the body works and the complex ecosystem that we are. But yeah, sometimes if people go on, you know, keto diets or just low carb in general or carnivore diets or whatever, then they can see changes in cholesterol. And it's not necessarily because you're eating more saturated fat or cholesterol. Sometimes it has to do with like energy delivery. You know, the body's running on fats, so it has to deliver more fats. And that means more LDL because that's what carries fats. Or sometimes even just fasting, like people do long fasts. There's studies that have shown that if you fast for a long time, your LDL goes up. It's because your body is starting to run on fat again. It needs to deliver that fat to the areas. And so that's one theory anyways. But then the question becomes, is that dangerous? Is cholesterol going up dangerous? Because I can list all the different things that cholesterol does in the body and why it's beneficial for us and all the important roles that it plays. But then people always say, well, what if it goes too high? Yes, having cholesterol around is good, but what if it goes too high? And if we look at studies on people who have what's called familial hypercholesterolemia, which is genetically high cholesterol, like really high, like they're talking LDL in like 500s, when it's supposed to be, you know, 100, because supposedly we see that when we analyze those people, they don't get sick or die any sooner than people who have quote unquote normal cholesterol. And the people who have that gene and do die sooner, it was actually because they did other things that weren't beneficial to them. They did things that damaged the cholesterol, like they didn't eat a whole foods diet or they smoked or they drank or they did all these things that damaged the cholesterol. It was more lifestyle driven than cholesterol driven. And so the other thing is that people should know is that this idea, like I mentioned before, this idea that cholesterol, you know, was problematic started because of this faulty research in the 1950s. And so in 1984, they finally got around to determining, like, officially, is cholesterol good or bad for you? And they put together this, you know, meeting. They had this meeting and they decided that it was bad based on what, I don't know. They decided that it was bad. And so after that, they put together these committees that were supposed to go, and this is in the United States, that were to go and teach doctors how to lower cholesterol in their patients and teach people or doctors about cholesterol. And at first, cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, which is these days supposed to be 100 or lower, apparently, they started off saying it should be 250 or lower. And then the pharmaceutical companies came in with these committees and they influenced the guidelines. And they said, we need to put it at 200. And then it went to 150. And then it went to 100.
Yeah.
And so because the lower the recommendation is, the more drugs can be prescribed,
yes.
Right? The more people who are seen as having high cholesterol, the more drugs can be prescribed, the more money the pharmaceuticals make. So that's kind of what happened, which tells me we have no idea what our total cholesterols are supposed to be. We're trying to analyze this thing that's different for everybody. And we really have no idea what normal actually is. But if we look at some studies, these are associational studies, so we can't really take them for everything that they are. But it's interesting if you look at the studies where we have cholesterol that is associated, the level of cholesterol that's associated with the lowest all-cause mortality. For total cholesterol, it's between 200 and 250, which the recommendation for total cholesterol is below 200. So that's actually what's associated with the lowest all-cause mortality is above the recommendations. And if we look at the number that's associated with the LDL, that's a number that's associated with the lowest all-cause mortality, it's between 100 and 150, which they tell us now it should be lower than 100, or some doctors want it lower than 70, when the level that's associated with the lowest all-cause mortality is much higher than that. So again, those are associational studies. We can't really prove anything from that, but it's just interesting to see that, you know? So that's the thing with cholesterol.
Yeah, it seems like they're just making up numbers. And now I heard that they're even trying to get kids to start on statins. But when can we take the statins? Is it
when do we need it? Yeah.
Is it helpful at all for something or no?
I would argue no. I would argue that if the body is elevating cholesterol to that level, it's doing so for a reason. The body's not stupid. Now, that reason may be something problematic that's going on in the body. And that problem may be that there's inflammation and damage to the arteries and things like that. And so I would argue that there may never be a case where a statin is indicated. But I technically, as a chiropractor, I'm not allowed to recommend that to anybody. But yeah, I mean, it's just because of the way we view it and how flawed that is, how flawed it is to think that one elevated molecule could be driving an entire chronic disease, and that by lowering it, we're going to fix that chronic disease. It makes no sense. And there's actually a study that came out in 2020 that looked at all the evidence of, you know, however long we've been lowering cholesterol with statins, and it's not working whatsoever. There are some studies that show that statins have this, what they call pleiotropic effect, where it has this small anti-inflammatory effect, which is good. And it's probably the only reason that we see any benefit from statins, is because it has this anti-inflammatory effect, not because it's lowering your cholesterol, but because it tends to decrease inflammation a little bit. But I would say there are much better ways to decrease inflammation in your body than to take a drug that's depriving you of life-giving cholesterol.
And we're going to come back to that in the next episode with you. But still, not everybody has the guts that you had when you were sick. So when just a random person goes to the doctor, sees the levels, and the doctor tells you to go on statins, what can we do? How can you give any advices for people who listens here now? What should they ask themselves?
It's a very hard situation. And I recognize that, because not everyone is as well-versed and things like as I am, you know? And so that's why I'm trying to, you know, put this information out there. But, you know, in this day and age, we have to stay informed. And unfortunately, you know, society has created this situation where you have to be really good or an expert at one thing. And that's, you know, whatever your career demands you to be an expert in. And you be good at that, and you go and do that, and then you outsource everything else. And so it's very hard when you're making this money and you go and you pay someone else to tell you about your health, if they're telling you something. And you would think we wouldn't have to go and be an expert in that as well. Mm. But unfortunately we do. And that's just the reality of it, is that you have to go and do your own research. You have to analyze what makes sense to you, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you that yes or no, you should take a statin, or yes or no, cholesterol is good or bad for you. Like that's an opinion that I've based off my experiences and all the research I've done, but also my personal experiences, my talking to other experts, and all that kind of stuff. And that's just where I've come to. But I fully recognize that someone else may not be there yet. And what's right for them may be to take that statin. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But mm-hmm. you have to also have the wisdom to understand that that may not be the case long term, right? It may change, and you should never stop trying to figure out if what you're doing is the correct thing to do or not. You know, I'm constantly trying to find, not trying, but I'm always on the lookout for things that tell me I shouldn't do sauna, you know, because there may be some out there. And if it's enough to convince me that I shouldn't do it, then I will all stop, you know, and that's just my own decision. And so that's just how it's got to be. You have to be your own health advocate, and you have to keep looking. Even if you make a health decision and you decide to take that drug or not take that drug, you should always be on the lookout for whether or not you should be. And if there's new information that comes up, and if you can't interpret that information because it's you're not well-versed in that, find someone who can. That's why I do health consulting, so I can help people kind of interpret that. And figure that out, you know? So,
right.
So yeah, it's probably not the black and white answer that people want. You know, they want concrete things to do, but it's just not a black and white situation. You've really got to, if you just have this natural adversity to drugs and you're just like, I don't know that that's going to correct the problem, then your head's in the right state. You just have to go and find the information that would back that up and then ask your doctor about it. You know, like you just got to keep searching and never give up and be open-minded and that kind of thing.
Keep asking questions.
Keep asking questions, that's for sure. And we want to ask you as a last question in this part, because you are really on top of your food choices as one of your levers to minimize heart risk. So what does a day of eating look like for you? Proteins, fat, are you keto?
Yeah, I'm largely, I guess, what I would call keto. I just say very low carb. I mean, I think that diet is good for most people, but for me particularly, because I'm type 1 diabetic, it's very easy to control blood sugars when I do that type of diet. I don't think that everybody has to be super keto or very low carb, but if they do have carbs, it should be very whole food carbs and not be their entire diet. You know, so my diet is very centered around animal foods and animal fats. I do some organ meats, and then I do plants as well. But I do very low carb plants, and I kind of use them to create variety. But my diet is my main nutrient, I guess, access is from animal foods. So whether it's chicken, beef, pork, organs, eggs, dairy, those types of things, and then some plants to spice it up a little bit.
Sounds amazing. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for this conversation. And we can't wait to get back to you with, we're going to talk about stress and supplements and HRV. Yeah. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Nå har vi mye å tenke på igjen av dette, men til dere der hjemme som synes dette var litt komplisert, så skal vi lage en liten oppsummering på norsk.
Ja, det skal vi, og følge på med del 2, for den omhandler masse spennende info om HRV knyttet til hjertehelse, om stress og konkrete løsninger for å bevare hjertet vårt i sin beste form. Vi ønsker dere en fortsatt nydelig uke!
Vi minner om at dere må snakke med egen lege eller kostholdsveileder om dieter og andre spørsmål relatert til medisiner og supplementer. Informasjon med dele kan ikke bli brukt til å diagnostisere, behandle, forebygge eller kurere noen sykdommer eller tilstander.
Julas tilbud og spar. Julefeiringen nærmer seg med stormskritt, og nå får du hele 40% rabatt på et stort utvalg Evergood kaffe. I tillegg får du også fersk krydder av tynnribber fra Folkets, før 149, nå kun 99 kroner per kilo. Alt I tilbud på noe godt. Hilsen oss I Spar.